Court asked in Russian.
Sudanese air traffic control has contacted us. There is a problem.
Tell me.
We have been diverted. We are no longer going to Khartoum.
Where are we going?
Al-Fashir.
Why?
I don't know, but I think perhaps the Sudanese army must need the guns there in a hurry.
Court pulled a laminated map off the flight engineer's table. The man looked up at him but did not protest.
Where the hell is Al-Fashir?
Asked Gentry as he unfolded the map. The Russian pilot turned and looked back over his shoulder and answered the question with one word, delivered in a grave tone.
Darfur.
He put his gloved finger on the far edge, completely across the country from where Court's operation was planned. Court looked up from the map.
Fuck. It is a problem for you, da?
My job is not in Darfur. Gennady said,
Nothing I can do. I have to divert. I don't have clearance to land in Khartoum.
Shit, said Gentry now. He tossed the headset back on the console and turned to leave the cockpit, yanking the map out with him. 5 minutes later, he was on his Hughes Thuraya satellite phone, talking with Sidorenko. He'd spent the time waiting for the connection to be established, looking over the map.
This is not acceptable. How am I supposed to get out of the airport at Al-Fashir, cross 100 miles of bandit-covered desert, plus another 300 miles of Sudanese territory? I've got the fucking Nile River now between myself and my objective.
Yes, Gray, I understand. It is a problem. You must let me think.
I don't have time for you to think. I need you to get this flight back on track.
But that is not possible. My influence is with Moscow, not Khartoum. You will have to land where the Sudanese instruct you to land.
If you can't fix this, then this operation is dead. You got that?
In fact, Court was concerned about Zaxop, Nocturne Sapphire, and not Sid's contract, but he did not mention this.
I will do my best.
Sid hung up, and Court continued pacing the narrow alley between the wall of the fuselage and the crates of guns. This snafu was of the shit happens variety. It was no one's fault. But Court knew from much experience that no blame need be assigned to an operation for it to fail completely and miserably. To Sidorenko's credit, he called back much quicker than Gentry had anticipated.
Mr. Gray, we have a solution. You must fly out again with the plane after it offloads in Al-Fashir. Return to the airbase in Belarus. There will be another flight to Khartoum in 3 days' time. It will be helicopter repair equipment, goods that are not likely to be delivered to Al-Fashir. Everything will be fine.
Sid seemed satisfied with the new arrangements.
3 days from now.
Correct.
1 day before Aboud goes to Suakin. That's not enough time to get there and prepare.
It would have been, thought Court, if Sidorenko's operation was the actual plan he intended on carrying out. It was not enough time, in Gentry's estimation, to adequately recon the area to increase the chances for success in Zach's operation. Again, he could not very well explain this to the man on the far end of the satellite connection. Sid shouted back across the line, his stress getting the best of him.
I can't help it. I had no way to foresee this. The Russian government did not foresee this. Just stay with the flight crew and come back. We will try again in 3 days.
Court hung up the phone and continued pacing the narrow corridor of the aircraft next to the weapons.
Son of a bitch.
He next used his phone to call Zach. Hightower took the call on the first ring. He was clearly surprised to hear from Gentry.
You're about 24 hours ahead of schedule, Six.
I'm about to fall behind schedule.
Court told Sierra One what was going on. When he was finished, he asked,
You know anything about this airport? Any way I can get out of here and over to Suakin?
You might as well be on the dark side of the moon. It's a war zone all around Al-Fashir. The Red Cross, private NGO relief agencies, the African Union troops working for UNAMID, the United Nations mission in Darfur, are about the only foreigners in the area. You might be able to buy a ride to the east from some local ballsy enough to brave the Janjaweed militia and the government of Sudan troops patrolling the Badlands, but I wouldn't recommend it. Stick with Sid's change to the op orders, retrograde out of the Sudan with the air crew, and reinsert in 3 days. It's the best we can do at this point. We'll just have to rush things when you get there. I'll let Carmichael know what's up.
Roger that, Six out.
Wait one.
Sack said. Just a piece of advice. Don't know what your turnaround time is in Al-Fashir, but stay the hell inside the airport grounds. If you get popped by the authorities over there, they'll take you to the ghost house. That sounds charming, Kurt said over the whine of the Ilyushin's engines changing pitch. They had just begun a turn to the south and a slight descent. It's anything but charming. It's the name the locals give to the government's secret prisons across the country. But the one in Al-Fashir is extra special. You go in the Al-Fashir ghost house, you don't come out, and you don't die quick. It is legendarily miserable. Understood. I'll avoid the local tour then. Six out. Chapter 15. Ellen Walsh's low spirits rose instantly when she saw a ray of the late afternoon sun glint off metal in the distant sky. It was an airplane, big and lumbering, turning onto its final approach, 1,000 meters above the brown highland plain of North Darfur. An aircraft landing here at Al-Fashir Airport meant a potential way out of this miserable place. Ellen had been stuck here since arriving on a UN transport plane ferrying in aid workers. There had been a problem with Walsh's documents. Her UNAMID travel authorization was missing the requisite stamp that would have allowed her entry into the UN camp for internally displaced people in Zamzam. This oversight meant she was not allowed to leave the airport, unless it was on a plane out of Al-Fashir. So for 3 days, she'd waited for a flight that would take her back to her office. UN aircraft had arrived, but they remained parked on the hot tarmac awaiting a resupply of UN jet fuel from a UN tanker. Chinese state-owned oil company planes had come and gone, but they'd returned to Beijing and not Khartoum, and they'd made it clear she would not go with them. Sudanese military flights had arrived and departed as well, but they weren't providing taxi service for some white woman. But this new aircraft, this mysterious arrival floating in the hazy mirage to the north and lining up on the runway, could be her ticket out of here. It wasn't military, it wasn't painted in UN white, and it did not have the same shape as the Chinese plane she'd seen. Ellen knew aircraft, and normally she could ID a cargo plane in a second, but this craft in the distance was now banking across the late afternoon sun and was therefore impossible for her to identify. But she did not care. Whatever type of plane it was, whoever was flying it, and wherever it was headed next, she determined to do everything in her power to see that she was on it when it left. Ellen was neither vain nor any sort of slave to fashion. But even before the lumbering aircraft touched down at the far end of the runway, she hurried back into the terminal to the restroom. She passed a pair of local Darfuri tribeswomen on their way out, dressed head to toe in colorful orange drapings, ushering 3 small children on ahead of them. The ladies' head wrappings were high and wide and, Ellen Walsh now realized, served as an effective foil for all the dust in the air. As she stepped up to the mirror for a look at herself, she nearly recoiled in horror. Her auburn hair looked ashen from the gray dust floating about. The faint creases around her eyes on her 35-year-old face were exaggerated by the dust and grime and salt from the sweat that had dried there. Quickly, she untied the white t-shirt from the outside of her backpack and drenched it in the dingy water flowing from the tap. She wiped her face with the makeshift washcloth. She had used the same shirt for the same task so many times in the past 72 hours that it was streaked and dulled from the filth scratched off her skin. She turned away from the tap, dipped her head forward towards the begrimed floor of the bathroom, and used her fingers to comb through her hair as she leaned over, pulling a dust cloud out of her shoulder-length locks. She rose, blew the bangs out of her eyes, and replaced her hairband. One more look in the mirror didn't fill her with relief, but it was an improvement. She retied the wet t-shirt to her backpack and hoisted it over a shoulder, then left the bathroom to return to the tarmac. She heard the huge engines long before she saw the aircraft. It taxied to a parking spot on the other side of the ramp of the 4 UN planes, some 400 meters from the door Ellen stepped through. In the dusty afternoon distance, she could not identify the 4-engine plane, but she did see there were no airline markings or country designation.
Still, from its shape, she could tell it was a cargo ship. She was momentarily caught up in the bevy of traffic as she began walking towards it. Several customs men and airport ground crewmen passed her on foot, as did 24 soldiers hanging off the sides of a pickup and 2 dilapidated flatbed trucks. She thought about letting all the activity approaching the new arrival die down before making her approach, but she decided to keep going. She had no idea how long this flight would be on the ground. Days were doubtful. Everyone who'd landed heretofore had gotten out of Al-Fasher as soon as possible if they had the fuel to do so. Hours would be likely if they were going to be offloading cargo. Minutes only if they were just here to take on fuel. She was not going to miss her chance. As Ellen walked towards the aircraft at the distant end of the ramp, it was partially obscured in the haze of a heat mirage pouring up from the cracked tarmac, the late afternoon air dimming just slightly, but not yet cooling. The air above the plane's hulking form quivered as vapors poured from the idling engines. After a moment, the pilot shut his engines down. The whine of the 4 big turbojets was replaced by the voices of the soldiers in the distance and the ceaseless sound of insects in the sandy scrub brush that ran along either side of the taxiway. The entourage of local army and airport workers was between her and the plane, moving purposefully across the hot taxiway, and they commanded her attention for the majority of her walk. She hesitated more than once, weighing the pros and cons of waiting for them to do their business and leave the aircraft, versus pushing right on through the gaggle of black men, some uniformed, some in business suits, and some in flowing white tobes, to speak immediately to the flight crew. Neither option looked particularly promising, but she quickly arrived at the conclusion that the latter choice seemed preferable to sitting back and waiting for a plane that might well just take off again into the sky without her. So she decided to walk right up the lowering rear hatch and take her chances. This decision caused her to look past the men 50 yards in front of her and turn her focus fully to the aircraft another 20 meters beyond them, and only then did her certain gait slow a bit. After a few yards, she slowed even more. And then, she stopped dead in her tracks on the blistering tarmac. With her eyes steady on the plane, she unslung her backpack and put it at her feet, unzipped it quickly, let a couple of sweat-stained blouses fall to the pavement as she pulled out a small black 3-ring binder. She knelt on her backpack as she quickly leafed through it. Her knees would have blistered had she placed them directly on the ground. 3 quick glances back up to the cargo plane and a few licks of her bone-dry fingertips helped her find the page she was looking for. Another look down at the page. Another look up at the plane in front of her. Yes. She muttered an exclamation that was not completely drowned out by the locusts and crickets around her.
Oh my God.
It was an Ilyushin IL-76, and from the look of its sagging disposition on its 10-wheel undercarriage, it was full of cargo. The IL-76 was an extremely common Russian-built transport aircraft in service with aid agencies and transport services and militaries throughout the hemisphere. But unless Ellen's eyes were deceiving her, this was an IL-76MF, an upgraded version with a longer fuselage. Slowly, she looked away from the plane as she collected her belongings off the tarmac. Slower still, she turned and began walking back to the terminal. Her excitement grew and grew as she sauntered nonchalantly in the afternoon heat, retracing her steps of moments ago. This excitement was tempered by the knowledge that she would not be able to make a phone call inside the building, as there wasn't a single public phone, and she'd been told the administrative line had been down for the past 72 hours. The airport administrators were lying, she had no doubt, but the effect was the same. She could not call her office. The excitement, tempered as it was, helped her think quickly as her mind raced to formulate a hasty plan. The scale of the opportunity before her could not be exaggerated, and she determined to control her emotions and focus on the opportunity at hand. Certainly, in her professional career, and almost certainly in her entire life, Ellen Walsh, Special Investigator for the International Criminal Court, had never felt so determined, nor so alone.
Chapter 16. This white woman is going to be a problem. Court had changed into an extra jumpsuit to match the rest of the flight crew, climbed down the rear ramp of the aircraft with the others, was slapped hard in the face by the heat and the stink of dry earth, and immediately squinted into the low afternoon sunlight, scanning the area to get his bearings. To his left, he saw an old white UN aircraft off in the sand, its tail broken off from the fuselage and evidence of a fire on board from the soot-covered windows and the partially melted and completely smoke-stained engines. To his right, a row of UN helicopters sat in the haze generated by the heat pouring off the engines of his own plane, the propellers of the choppers dipping low as if melting. Behind them were several airplanes parked wingtip to wingtip. They looked like they could be small UN transport craft. A tiny, new-looking terminal was up ahead several hundred yards. To the right of it was a fence line out in the sand that ran alongside a road, with several more junked and wrecked aircraft deposited nearby. Bugs were everywhere, flies, mosquitoes, locusts that he could not see but could easily hear out in the thickets alongside the dusty taxiway. And then he noticed her in the mid-distance. It was hard to miss a white female alone on a sunny airport tarmac in western Sudan. From 50 yards away, he watched her take note of his plane and drop to her bag, pull out a book, and thumb through it. He watched her pause to read the page, then stand slowly with her hands on her hips. Then she began retreating, slowly but unmistakably to the terminal, well aware, Gentry had a strong suspicion, that the aircraft behind her was not supposed to be there. Yep, this white woman was definitely going to be a problem. Court remained in the background of the conversation and listened to the pilot Gennady speak English with the Sudanese military officials at the foot of the ramp. The trucks coming to offload the guns were behind schedule. It would be another hour before they reached the airport. Fuel for the Ilyushin was available and would be provided immediately, and an airport official would show the men the way to the washrooms and the restaurant. They had parked alone at the far end of the taxiway. This was to keep the few civilians and foreign aid workers milling about the terminal from getting near enough to the unmarked cargo plane to see something they shouldn't. Still, Gennady and his flight crew were invited by the Sudanese to enjoy the comforts of the terminal while they waited for the plane to be unloaded and refueled. After the Sudanese had wandered off, Gentry asked Gennady to keep his men on the aircraft. From a security perspective, Court saw no benefit in the Russian men wandering among the civilians. But the pilot was in charge, not the stowaway. And he told his men they would be wheels up in 3 hours and would need to be back on the aircraft in two, but until then, they could do as they pleased. 20 minutes later, Court and the Ilyushin's flight crew stepped out of the oppressive late afternoon heat and into a stairwell at a side entrance to the terminal's concourse. Court almost stayed behind himself, but he wanted to keep his eyes on the Russians to make sure they behaved themselves. He did not have any gear with him at all. His gun remained back on the plane in his pack. He had no idea what security measures he might find here, and did not want to run the risk of getting frisked by some local version of the TSA. Only his wallet full of euros, rubles, and Sudanese pounds bulged the lines of his olive drab flight suit. The stairs led up one level into a nearly empty concourse, smaller than a typical American supermarket. A few locals milled about, and GOS soldiers sat on the floor or strolled around with their assault rifles hanging upside down off their backs. The flight crew, with their secret foreigner hidden in with them, found the bathrooms and used them, then found the tiny restaurant and sat down. A waiter who proclaimed himself Egyptian, as if these Russians cared, energetically greeted the men and passed around menus. None of the Russians spoke Arabic. Court, on the other hand, had spent more than enough time in the Arab-speaking world to order a meal, but he held his tongue. He was not about to differentiate himself from the rest of the flight crew by becoming their translator. Gennady ordered for the table. He'd been here in Al-Fashir many times before, which, Gentry realized, should not have come as a surprise. Flagrant disregard for international sanctions by the government of an African despot was de rigueur, as was the Russians' eagerness to benefit from it, as was the United Nations' shock and outrage each and every single time that they became aware of it. While they waited for their food, Court's eyes continued scanning the environment. They were still adjusting to the low light inside the terminal compared to that on the tarmac. He looked back over his shoulder down the hallway and cringed inwardly. Shit, here comes the white woman. This he didn't need.
Excuse me, do any of you gentlemen speak English?
Ellen smiled broadly, directing her question towards the pilot as she knelt next to him at the head of the table. She could tell he was in command by his countenance and bearing. He sat erect at the table full of men in sweat-soaked jumpsuits. There were 5 men in the flight crew. All wore matching green uniforms, no names or emblems or markings of any kind. None of the men were particularly military-looking in their hairstyles or fitness levels, but Ellen knew better than to draw too many conclusions too quickly. These could be military pilots working for Rossiboron Export or former Russian military. Either way, it didn't matter.